Dave, are we sharing, or is are you sharing with Alonzo over there?
We're on right now.
Yeah, I'm sharing with him. Linoleum knife.
Oh boy, so much happening. You know what? And actually, at some point, we're gonna have to pause because I haven't sent you this week's promotional message announcement.
Oh, okay.
But we'll get to that momentarily.
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic of Movies.com. Also, it's Alonzo Duralde sharing my microphone. He's the film critic of The Wrap. And what the flick? We have three guests, many things to talk about.
Yeah, we're not even going to.
We're sharing a microphone, and let's go.
Okay, so it's our best of 2014 show. We'll talk about Taken 3 for like 5 seconds, which is about all it deserves. But we're thrilled to have with us a blue ribbon panel around the table.
Woo.
They've all been on the show before. You know them, you love them. Manolo Dargis of the New York Times.
Robert
Abley of the Los Angeles Times, and all the way from the Paris Bureau, Peter DeBruge of Variety. Welcome, one and all.
International guests.
Right. Do we have to call you Peter? Peter, how are you?
As you wish. Comme vous voulez.
Well, when you're, I mean, please, DeBruge, I'm sure, was like, oh, Belgian.
Right. There, everyone looks down on me.
We don't roll with that. All right, so yay, thank you all for being here.
We need to address the subject of the theme music.
Oh, well, yeah, what, faces
which
were being
was
made?
Confusing to President Dargis, who, that theme music was composed by us for this show. This is our theme song.
No, for us, not by us.
Oh,
by our friend Blue.
Did I say by us?
You did.
I meant for us.
Well, I know you're talented.
I am.
By our friend Blue, and we asked for a 30-second instrumental, and he gave us that, and we love it. So
it's awesome.
It's a 30-second instrumental with la 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 la.
Well, we didn't ask for that, but we got it.
We got la la.
Yes,
it's
very
good.
Happy.
Very nice.
So we were just starting before the mics went on, talking about how, you know, this is the awardee time of year. The Golden Globes are tonight. Hoo ha! And there is this weird bias about what kind of movies are deemed award worthy, and what kind of genres are deemed award worthy, and which ones aren't. And I mean, 'twas ever so, right? I mean, comedies have always had a hard time getting taken seriously. You know, the occasional Kevin Kline will sneak in, you know, but for the most part, it's like, that's, I don't know, is it low, or is it just not considered like capital I important? What's that about?
By the way, I have a question, Manolo, because all of us saw each other last night at the Los Angeles Film Critic Awards, but you don't participate in any of those, right? Sort of as a New York Times policy thing?
I mean, yeah, no, nice I, to... we're not allowed to. We're not allowed to be in any new groups, so I can't be in New York, LA, or the National Society.
It's sort of a blessing. I mean, I feel like there's this weird contestification of kind of movies. You know, it's like every film festival, not every, but most of, you know, these juries, and of course at the end of the year there's this derby between movies that, you know, like aren't the movies that normal people really want to see.
And some of us don't want to see those either.
It's why I'm not in any critics groups too.
Oh, please.
I'm too.
You're just mooching on
movies,
my screeners.
Movies,
that's all.
Movies.com. The prestige outlet that I write for. They
you could totally go like online, but you don't want to sit through a
meeting. They won't allow me.
You just want to sit. You want to hear my horror stories about our meetings. Although
so
our meetings got a lot.
I'm kind of just like Manola.
Yeah, exactly. That's what everyone thinks.
There's a
hey, it's Dave White, the Manola of online.
I think the critics groups. It seems like the origin of a lot of those groups was initially to kind of work as a balance, as a counterweight rather, to a kind of mainstream idea of quality movies, you
sure.
know, and I think including what the Academy would choose, and that I think that there was a kind of function for them. I think the thing that has become kind of apparent and is lamentable or not lamentable, but it just is the way that the critics groups have been hijacked, sometimes willingly so, as part of what you call the awardee season, you know, and the idea that we even now speak of the quote-unquote award season is really, I feel like definitely the cart has been leading the horse for quite some time, that the awards race, as it were, this derby that Peter mentioned, is now seems to actually be much more important than the movies themselves. Mm. You know, that there's actually, you know, this entire industry dedicated to,
there are people whose jobs all year is to just handicap this
stuff.
It's
astonishing.
Well, there are movies that are probably only greenlit because they just want to prepare them for awards, the awards race.
Well, my job, I mean, that's, by the way, the worst sort of way to make a movie, because it's like when you sort of go intending to sort of collect a whole bunch of glitter for your movie, then it's like, then it's not, I mean, it's sort of like the by accident ones that seem to work out well. But, I mean, my job at Variety, in addition to or before I was sort of able to make being a film critic the full-time focus, was editing feature sections. And a big way that Variety supports itself is, you know, through, because it's an industry trade paper that, you know, people advertise to the industry to sort of like get attention for these four-year consideration ads, all that kind of stuff, and we do screening series, and it was a big part. So like, you know, 8 of the 9 years I've spent at Variety were sort of being part of that. There are worse things in life than writing about, quote, the best films of the year for, you know, 5 months of the year when that's all competing. But like the point that you're making, Manola, is that, you know, those films that are kind of invested in winning those prizes are not necessarily the ones that artistically, certainly not from an international independent standpoint, are the best.
I like to think, though, that LAFCA, you know, mixes it up a bit, and a lot of the other critics groups too. I mean, you know, I don't think the Academy is going to acknowledge Tom Hardy this year. I certainly don't think they're going to, you know, acknowledge Agata Kulesza for Ida, you know. Mm-hmm. And you've got New York doing, you know, Marion Cotillard for, you know, The Immigrant, and you've got, I mean, geez, National Society just gave Best Picture to Goodbye to Language.
Yeah. I'm not attacking critics, and, you know, remember, I was the president of LAFCA and the vice president. I put in my time, baby. So, you know, I think it more is that, absolutely, and I think it does, I do think that the really good critics groups do still serve that function in terms of being a kind of a counterweight to a kind of mainstream push. At the same time, there is definitely, you know, the kind of red carpet opportunity. And now it just seems that the red carpet now basically starts to furl at Cannes and keeps unfurling all through Toronto, Telluride,
well,
and on.
Now, this past year, I mean, I feel like, you know, some of those sort of things were sort of launched there. You know?
Yeah.
But of course, Cannes is the one where it's sort of viewed as that sort of opportunity.
Well, it's only in an awards race that you can have people who agree about the worth of a performance, like, have an argument because of the awards race. Like, the way we were attacked for giving Patricia Arquette Best Actress for Boyhood instead of Best Supporting Actress, which is what she's being pushed, you know, by IFC, you know, it's like everyone agrees that she's great, and now people are mad at us because we gave her
Best Actress
because we've hurt her chances to win an Academy
that's
Award.
Absurd.
It's like, that's when you realize that things are way
so
out
much
of
that coverage, and I appreciated that Variety. It was not about handicapping the race; it was just about spotlighting these. And maybe that was, you know, to be more, you know, equanimous to all of the. Is that the right
equanimous,
way to say it?
I think.
Sorry, I'm losing control of my English.
Equalized.
It's your second language now.
You're looking
equal.
Right. I mean, to sort of like not, you know, scare away any potential advertisers, perhaps. But I mean, the benefit of that is that, like, it's not about statistics or, like, you know, horse betting or the kind of, you know, stuff where it really is kind of like handicapping the Oscars at so many of the other places. And that's where the something like the, you know, which category, the worth of a performance is a valid thing. But second guessing what a bunch of oldsters are going to say about, you know.
Right. It's just that we now have people who will actually review a movie. I'm not going to say who they are, but there are people out there who will now review a movie, and actually kind of the gauge is whether or not they're Oscar worthy.
Okay.
I have literally read
in the race now. You'll see
or they're not
like
in the race, and you know what were they thinking?
Or the race is over.
Right. Yeah. And as if somehow that movie exists, and there are movies that, of course, like that completely do not exist to win Oscars. They're there because someone is actually interested in being an artist, let's say. I know that's kind of crazy.
I made a rule for myself to only reference Oscars in a review in a negative way. Like, I have said this performance is so terrible, it's a sure bet to be nominated. Beyond that, I won't.
That's awesome.
I love that policy.
That's a great policy. I think everyone should embrace it.
So, all right. So let's talk about then some of our favorite genre films this year, because we were talking about movies that made our top 10 that we know aren't going to get.
And I say that because even I fall.
I'm sorry, we're going to pause for a second. Okay, so I, in my top 5, had The Babadook. which is a horror film, which is certainly, I think, on the list of genres not taken seriously by awardsy folks. I'm not a big horror fan, but oh my god, that movie,
that's a well-made movie,
really unsettled me. And Dave told the world on Twitter that while I was listening to it in another room on headphones, that I was like making yelpy shouty noises. Dave hasn't seen it yet.
That's the reason for Twitter.
No, but like
to bust your that's
right. But it's one of those things where you, I mean, and I fall victim to the very thing of, where you kind of look at genre movies a different way. And I always think, oh, I gotta put one genre movie in my top 10. Like, you know, I'm gonna put one just purely entertaining film. That I like, but if I love a movie, why wouldn't it be my top 10? I mean, I'd put in Edge of Tomorrow in my top 10 because I think it's maybe the most fun I had in a movie all year. And I thought that was incredibly enjoyable summer entertainment. And so I put that in my top 10.
It's in my top 20. I agree. I think it's really formally inventive.
Live, Die, Repeat.
Which is the great title.
I know. They really screwed up with the title. Yeah. They should have used that one.
Or, or All You Need Is Kill, which was the original book.
Yeah.
I mean, top 10 lists are almost like, you know, film critic mixtapes or something, too. And so there is the kind of like where, and it's also the flow. I mean, I even realized, because it's apples and oranges. Like, I mean, how do you compare Live, Die, Repeat, you know, to Selma or something? They're just not the same kind of movie. And it's right. Like, and how do you rank them relative when it's a degree of love or something? And it's like, I mean, I remember as I was doing my top 10 this year, I don't even know if they're like how you kind of exactly score them. You know, there are some critics who like God, who is it? Mike D'Angelo, who does the like 100-point scale and can come up with like, you know, a grade for each movie, right? You know, it's like,
but life is too short, man.
I have to do that for Metacritic. They ask me for that score, and I have to sort of make, and then for what the flick too. We score 1 to 10 with decimal points.
Right.
Yeah, I don't like it, but I gotta.
But I mean, like, I went from like Love is Strange, which I adore, you know, the Iris Sachs, you know, kind of, you know, movie, to Le Weekend, because Love is Strange in that movie too. You know, even though it's like, I mean, that movie clunky in some ways and totally sincere and beautifully acted and beautifully, beautifully written in others. And no one, I think, saw Le Weekend outside of critics, but it's like, I mean, that's a little treasure that's sort of fallen off of this quote.
Yeah, Ingu put it on her top 10 list. That's one I still need to catch up on. I didn't see it.
I don't do a top 10 anymore. I kind of stopped doing them. What I do is, you know, I've been doing like I did like a top 40 one year, you know? And part of the problem is that, you know, in New York, we had almost 100 movies open in 2014. And, you know, I see
almost 100?
I'm sorry, almost 1,000. Okay. Sorry. Right. Almost 1,000 movies open. And, you know, I'm not seeing, you know, I'm not even seeing a third of that. I see a couple hundred movies a year, you know, and I see a lot, like I watch a lot of, rewatch movies, you know, so I don't keep a count, but I'm definitely seeing a couple hundred, but I can't pretend that I'm actually in any way seeing most of the movies that are opening in New York. So now I'm just doing like the movies that made, you know, mattered the most to me. Mm-hmm. And also I just feel like I had different emotional reactions to things. I mean, I think the Godard is amazing, but I also have love Boyhood. But then I have great love for Selma, but different kinds of love, different kinds of respect. And to kind of just say 1 to 10. I mean, the only time I think I didn't do that was the year that There Will Be Blood and Zodiac came out. And I was just like, well, there's those two movies and there's nothing else.
Generally, it comes, like when I'm just thinking about it, I think I come up with 5 quickly that I would put on a top 10, and then the rest are kind of just, I go for that variety, that sense of like, you know,
representation.
Let's put in something like, I added Level 5, this Chris Marker movie that really only got its first full release in theaters this year, and it's from like 1980 or something, and I just thought it was pretty amazing that this movie felt so relevant all these years later and getting its first release, and I just thought that's a great one to put in.
I'm kind of a top 10 Nazi, by the way. Like, that thing that you just did. You know, or those bastards who put, like, Army of Shadows number 1 of the year that my favorite filmmaker is, you know, Jean-Pierre Melville.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean, it's like the idea that, like, basically the subtext of that choice is saying, no film this year is as good as a film that wasn't the best film of its year. You know, and it's a sort of like insult against.
I mean, it's all bullshit anyway, so why do you care?
Yes.
Sorry.
It's okay.
That said, though, I mean, this year, I mean, like, because I was living abroad, I haven't seen still American Sniper yet. I haven't been able to catch it. So it's like, how do you, and the implication if a film is not on your list is that it wasn't good enough to make it. It's not that, you know, that you haven't seen it. And this year I broke all my rules. I mean, I've got movies that, like, you know, I saw because I spent the year on the festival circuit. Mm-hmm. You know, four of the movies on my list, you know, sort of don't have U.S. distribution, I think, or haven't come out yet. You know, it's like, they're just sort of, it's this kind of, you make up your own rules and you're beholden.
Yeah, no, I almost put Romer's Tale of Summer on my list this year because that got its first U.S. release. And then I thought, that's maybe a little precious.
And I didn't put
But why? I mean, there is no, the thing is, like, there's no rules here.
No,
you make rules. You make your own rules.
I just personally felt like
you
it
didn't
was,
want to do that, and I've been walking around feeling like I was too precious for the past 7 months because I love Stray Dogs so much. Tommy Lang film that never got released in Los Angeles. It played here one night
but it's a new movie.
I know it's a new movie, but it was so
in the global scope of 2014, it is a new movie.
So limited that when I walked around telling people, oh, this movie's so incredible, this movie's so incredible.
What did you find incredible about that movie?
There's another.
Tale of Summer? Stray Dogs.
It's Stray Dogs. Because I mean, I have tried to catch up to the Liang, or Sai, which is his last
name. I can't say his name.
Tried to catch up to that train, and I can only watch his movies on fast forward on my DVD. That one I went into the theater, and it was just like, you know, clawing my eyes out, especially for the 20-minute end, you know, shot
of
it.
He's a fan.
I'm a gigantic fan of this guy. And
many people are. I mean, it's just like...
I will say, I can't watch his stuff on a TV. Because
it needs your undivided.
Because I'm distracted by my house, by my everything. But you know, sitting in the Hammer Theater, and it's 2.5 hours, and there's like the final shot is like this 14-minute thing of two people looking at something, and you don't even know what they're looking at.
That's great, but I think that's actually the important. That's the cinematic experience.
Yes,
you know,
and so that's
that relationship.
That's important to me to be able to see that in that way, And it bugged me because I saw it in like March or April, whenever the Hammer screened it, and I spent all year people saying, "Well, what's your favorite movie this year?" And I said, "That one," and then I have to explain it. And the more I talked about it, the more I thought, "You're gonna just sound like a dick by the end of the year because no one got to see this movie."
There's
a week at the Film Forum in New York.
No, but that is what critics R4 can do.
Right.
That's what these awards, you know, that we give out are for. It's like, and that's why.
But you can see
Army
the face
of
the people when you're talking to. Their face is like, all right, you can stop talking about this movie.
The idea, we intentionally go out of our way to pick things that are obscure. And it's like, no, it's just because it didn't get picked up by Disney doesn't mean it wasn't a good movie. It has this small audience. But I'm with you, though, about the, like, you start with a 5 and then kind of fill in the rest.
Yeah.
I had 3 this year. Since like the first half of the year, strangely enough, for me it was Boyhood, Locke, and We Are the Best. Like those were
I thought you were gonna say Grand Budapest because my Boyhood and Grand Budapest early on in the year, it never went away. Those top two for me. So
and then everything else, and even those three juggled in position for a long time, and then it was sort of the rest of the list.
I mean, at this point, in a way, I think like what the best value of the top 10 is to draw attention to movies that people wouldn't necessarily see, you know, and then maybe also write about a topic, you know, like if along with that, if you're feeling a little bit more ambitious, because otherwise, I mean, everything else has been so heavily promoted through the year, the studio stuff in particular, that, you know, in terms of, again, providing some sort of counterweight to that kind of industrial complex, you know, the cinematic industrial complex, I think that's what we can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I put a movie on this year that I had put on last year because I just didn't bother to check, and someone, like, one of the readers wrote me, and I'm like, it's so good, I had to put it on twice.
Which was that?
Monica and Mana, which is a
we've discussed that on this show.
You know? So it's been at a festival 1 year, and it comes out the next. Yeah, yeah.
No, I put a movie on Gloria that kind of was also a movie kind of considered last year too.
Yeah,
January. Yeah.
Yeah, it might have been on my list last year. I don't remember exactly, but I just thought I want to mention this movie.
Yeah, I think I think I might have done Ernest and Celestine twice. I'm not sure because it was.
But again, I mean, it's like the it's an opportunity to share this enthusiasm that we have, especially for type. I mean, the flip side is there's this compulsion to be individualist and to not put the movies that like are terrific and big and like are getting a lot of push and attention, you know, or might be in the O-word conversation. And it's like those belong there too. And I remember someone like Ebert, it almost felt like his films would line up almost exactly with the Academy ballots at the end of the year, but he sincerely loved those movies and he would always find a way to kind of sneak in there's one or two slots for the
But others. There's always that strain of, you know, there's a group of critics who are always going to be the kind of the no side. And that's fine. And they serve a function, you know. But mm-hmm. they're anything that they think smacks of, like, you know, I don't like the term Oscar bait because I think that's really, because even though if some movies are made perhaps to win awards, I'm not really sure if that's true or not. But I don't think we should condemn the movie and all the effort and the work that went into it.
For fitting into a niche.
Oh, exactly.
I wouldn't call it that in a review. No.
Yeah, no, of course not. I'm not saying you would, but I'm just saying, you know.
Well,
I mean,
called St. Vincent that, because that movie to me felt like there was no other reason for it to exist than to give, like, Bill Murray.
I think anything that the Weinsteins put out, you can call Oscar Murray.
But that has to do with their strategy. I mean, it's like, and the reason that they sort of shied away from Grace of Monaco when they realized it wasn't that kind of movie, which is too bad because that movie's not as awful as mm-hmm. it's been labeled. It's just
oh, there's a poster quote.
I mean, like, I think that movie is like, it's just like, it's a middle of the road Ron Howardy kind of movie that would play to our mothers, you know. But maybe for like people who see as many movies as we do, it's like we anticipate all of its kind of little moves. But it's like, it's got a fine performance, you know, multiple fine performances in it. One truly terrible one by like Parker Posey is kind of this, like, you know.
Hilarious. That's a hilarious performance, yes.
Kind of like very camp, you know. It's like, she's hedging her bets on that performance. Like, the movie could go either way. But anyway, I mean, but when Harvey realized that movie didn't have any Oscar chances, he suddenly tried to drop it. Because, like, I mean, anyway.
Yeah, it's never been released in the U.S.
It's all business related. I mean, it's like, if that movie gets awards, then he can meet the obligation he had in terms of the amount of money, how wide it's going to go, all these kind of things. And when it doesn't have Oscar chances, then he can't spend to, you know, get the advertising out there. But the, sorry, I lost the original train of thought. Talk amongst yourselves.
Sorry, you were saying that not calling movies Oscar bait.
Yeah, because I think it's unfair to the filmmakers, you know? I mean, it's like, it's not necessarily a filmmaker's fault that, let's say, you know, Harvey Weinstein bought their movie. Right. And in some cases, as with James Gray, it was completely not what he wanted. You know, James Gray directed The Immigrant, which it had an interesting and rather tortured history.
And the best female performance of the year, in my opinion, Marianne Cotillard. You know, it's like, but like last year, 12 Years a Slave is certainly not a film that I feel like was made with any intention of Oscar. And yet, by virtue of its distributor, it's like they recognized it had potential and they groomed it and they led it to that kind of, that path, but
it's time. That was the that was the thing that they put on the posters. And when I remember for 12 Years a Slave, they had just "It's time," and I remember reading that and thinking, "You got to be kidding!"
Yeah,
that's terrible.
Why not just put a picture of broccoli?
But it was just like, but they knew the account. You know, they knew exactly what they were doing.
I mean, the way that he made that film was, it was you know, not safe. It was not gentle.
He didn't make
it to
win Oscars.
No.
This is gross.
It is a Steve McQueen movie. Mm-hmm. Through. But what bugs me though about the whole sort of awards thing is that this year I think Selma faces a much more uphill battle, because for a lot of Oscar voters it's kind of, oh well, we gave it
last year. Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's like,
we're done.
Just like check off a box, black people appeased.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, really, seriously.
Yeah. They at least get a decade, you know, before we have to go back to that.
You can see Harvey Weinstein taking out a different ad that says, "Last year was time. Now we're talking The Imitation Game," or something like that. You know, it's like...
I thought the strange connection between 12 Years of Slave and Boyhood both being 12 years movies.
Well, Boyhood was originally called 12
years. It was indeed the original title.
it's funny. The Weinstein strategy for Imitation Game now is to make all the ads about Alan Turing. So it's like, we're now giving awards to real people for having existed and doing things. And
you know what's really interesting is, have you seen the ads where they're like, he was persecuted because he was gay?
Mm,
which is, yeah, and so they're actually doing that. I saw a double truck ad in the New York Times, you know, that he was... And what's so interesting, because the movie doesn't deal with his sexuality at all.
No, really.
It doesn't not deal with it at all. It deals with it
dumbly also.
Well, it just has it as a framing thing, but it doesn't deal with, like, you know, really in the way that I would.
It's an icing on the cake.
Yeah, and when it does come up, it's come up in stupid ways where like straight people tell him, oh, you need to like keep that a secret.
Tone it down.
Like any gay person ever didn't get that growing up, especially in a country where it's illegal to be gay.
No, listen, I adore that movie though, and it took a real adjustment though, because the interesting part of Turing's life is the later chapters where he, you know, agreed to take this sort of like chemical, you know, kind of
hormone therapy.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, and then ultimately sort of like, you know, killed himself with a cyanide and
well, that guy had so many aspects of his life you could have made anything into a movie. It reminds me of the reaction I had to Unbroken, where you're like, where you see this 2 hours of this guy being tortured, and then at the end it gives you three crawls, and you go like, well, that's the movie I would.
I'd see him go back to Japan him, and you know, the Forgiveness Tour. Yeah,
yeah. I think Wesley Morris in that big long piece, he has one little line.
He was broken.
Unbroken. He was broken. You find out by that line. So why don't we get to see that?
And for that matter, I would put American Sniper in that category. It's like shoot. Oh wait, I'm gonna help other veterans, and then boom, crawl. Oh, yeah, he's dead.
I love that movie.
Well, you're a Clint lady.
Well, not at all. Okay. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But this one, absolutely.
I think it's a great movie.
Here's the thing: if you're gonna include that part at all at the end, give it a little more, because it was such a turn on a dime. I'm going to help veterans, and then Sienna Miller saying, "Oh, honey, you're so much better now," and then dead.
I disagree.
I think the whole movie
you're watching him.
Yeah.
I don't think any of those war scenes have a rah-rah quality to them, and I don't think his performance at all is rah-rah.
I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just saying that the turn from him being haunted and brooding and messed up by everything to getting his life back together to then dying is handled.
Spoiler alert!
It's a real life guy.
Yeah, I didn't know when I saw the movie.
We
saw different movies. No, and I'm not. I actually haven't reviewed the last couple ones because unintentionally.
Well, no, I knew you. I didn't. But I'm not saying you're a Jersey Boy fan, and no one.
No, I wrote about that reluctantly, but I also didn't write about the South African one, and there was another one.
You reviewed J. Edgar though, didn't you?
Oh, I like J. Edgar a lot.
And, but
yeah.
Didn't you review it though?
I did, but there was a couple others in between that I didn't review. So, I liked this movie a great deal, and it was. I mean, I was very affected by it. I thought it was very emotionally. And I thought I was seeing something I hadn't seen. I mean, I think it's a kind of amazing movie. And if this is a spoiler alert, so, you know, cover your ears for the next 15 seconds. You know, to have a movie very quickly where the ostensible hero of the film, you know, kills a child is kind of an astonishing thing. I think for, you know, I haven't seen that movie. So, you know, you say, this is...
The Woman in Black does it a lot.
This is the movie. Yeah, I mean, you know, seriously, this is a movie that's saying, this is what we demand of people when we ask them to go to war. We ask them to kill children. That's a kind of astonishing
thing.
And
I think it's a deliberate director's choice that the scariest looking guy, if he kills all these people in the movie, you know, these, whatever, you know, what does he call them? What's the pejorative word they use?
I don't remember. Yeah.
But, you know, all the people overseas he kills in the war, and then the scariest looking guy in the movie is the guy at the end, the veteran that he meets. I mean, that's a choice. That's a director saying... Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's...
You know, it's interesting because it sounds like that movie, which I haven't seen yet, it sounds like it doesn't go, I mean, because it's more about kind of like duty and kind of honor and the kind of things you do as a soldier and what you accept, you know, it's like, versus this sort of like the new Andrew Niccol movie, which you saw too, right, in the one about the drones.
I haven't seen that.
It was in Venice, you know, sort of with Ethan Hawke. It's kind of like, you know, an actual pilot who's kind of reassigned to...
Oh, I think, you know, I walked out of it. Actually, I tried to see it. Or I may have seen the whole thing.
I mean, it's
sorry. It's some sort of blur from Toronto.
It's interesting and it's smart, but it's also kind of like, it's such an author's license of kind of like this kind of hypothetical, like, you know, what are the kind of moral, you know, issues I would have as, you know, kind of a liberal kind of informed person in that situation versus like, what is the job asking? And I mean, like, in drone strikes, he's frequently having to decide about, you know, kind of collateral damage and these kind of things, the greatest good and whatnot.
Well, getting back to...
should we go on to a little happier?
Yes. Well, you know, I was thinking about it, that we were having this conversation about genre, that actually in my list, I did work in The Raid 2.
Yes.
Which I think is just a breathlessly exciting and... You know, it is the MGM musical of super intense martial arts movies. It is so amazingly choreographed and just like it keeps escalating on itself, and I had the best time with that.
Top five, as far as genre.
I didn't see top five. I need to. Okay. It's still on my list, but my comedy on my list was Obvious Child.
I love that movie, and I love the screenplay for that movie.
Yeah.
It's just like, a romantic comedy in, that centers around the subject of abortion, it just feels like, there was also that episode of the... No, go ahead.
I hate that movie.
So yes, I'd rather hear...
I'm in between you guys.
I have actually nothing to say about the movie, except that it's so badly made that it hurt my eyeballs watching it. And I was in such, physical...
And yet you like Goodbye to Language.
Which is, because I think
that's
it's really
beautiful.
That's
an assault on your eyeballs, which is different.
Which is a different thing.
Goodbye to Language is gloriously beautiful.
I also think it truly is beautiful.
True.
No, I think it's really... I think it's gorgeous. Whereas Obvious Child has nothing that I would call technique... I mean, it just doesn't in any way, what is... this is not a movie. I was so profoundly upset.
Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas. This is not a movie gets escalated
okay,
to a whole
okay.
new
I was just so completely... And it, because of I mean, that, I, because I have that reaction, I just shut down. And
I hear
laugh
what you're saying.
All.
It didn't... Because there are movies like that that you can tell, is there a cinematographer?
This is so horrible. I can't watch it.
But Obvious Child didn't take... I never got taken out of it by the way it looked. I just sort of went with, okay, it's a low-budget movie. It's this, it's that.
And I think it was a deliberate... I think it's one of these movies that's deliberately trying to be anti-technique.
No.
I'm not saying it's a good thing that it's doing that. I think there's a willfulness to not actually have technique in the movie.
That's a weird defense. I mean, I like the movie.
I'm not defending it. I don't think I like that, actually.
I love you, Robert Abley, but no.
It's sort of giving them credit for amateur hour in certain aspects. But I do think that... I mean, I do think the writing in that movie is just side-splitting. And I think it goes somewhere. And I love Jenny Slate's performance.
Well, if I had heard it as a radio play, maybe I would have liked it.
Look at a movie like Clerks, or maybe it's maybe a bad example. But I mean, I think of a lot of the early Kevin Smith stuff. The writing is, if you're there, if it works for you at all, it's the writing. And so you're willing to forgive it a certain amount of kind of visual static.
Admit,
I don't know. He's like genre noir compared to her. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, that's where American independent cinema is parked. In that spot where they just, reason, there's such a lack of technique. And so when you see something like Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, or Short Term 12 has, a vision, or The
Agreed.
Witch, which will be at Sundance. Yeah. And it's like these things,
I just want to say, I see so many movies every year that are in that Obvious Child.
Yes,
I know you do.
And God bless you.
Yeah, and I see so many that I feel like are truly there's no technique because they don't know what they're doing. The Obvious Child did feel like there was that they were trying to achieve a certain kind of like maybe she watched
grungy
a lot of
New York
and she wants to there.
I know, but someone like Andrew Bujalski actually can make good looking movies. Listen up, Phillips.
Really cool.
His movies are beautiful.
If you have bothered to write characters and you have bothered to have funny situations and lines that make me laugh, I am immensely forgiving of what a movie looks like.
See, the vision thing, though, like the eyeball, like my eyes bleeding, it's just like...
The flip side is then there's a tendency to overpraise those who master the technique, a la
Ain't Them Body Saints, which looked great, it was awful!
High five!
Ain't Them Body Saints, beautiful film,
Bradford Young being an amazing cinematographer, but you're just thinking...
And he had a great year this year. He shot Selma, Most Violent Year... Was there another
one? Oh my God, Most Violent Year is such a good movie. How come people aren't talking about
it?
It's
in my top 10. It opened December
31st.
Well, I know. Jessica Chastain was contractually forbidden from talking about any other movie besides Interstellar for the last half of last year.
But that's
year.
Not un- actually uncommon. I don't want to just beat up on. Yeah, from what I understand, it's not unprecedented. Let's put it that way.
By the way, that movie is being over celebrated in Paris right now. I mean, because the way Most Violent Year. I mean, because the way that a little digression. Interstellar.
Please.
I'm glad that I got to see Interstellar in the one theater in Paris that was showing it in 35mm. I'm glad I got to see it in Paris because it had subtitles in French.
Oh, so you could hear the dialogue.
Oh, the dialogue. I didn't understand. I could read and retranslate to myself.
That's so funny.
Because this is now a pattern of Nolan's where it's like he gave all those lines to Bane. scene.
And then don't you mock my boyfriend.
No, I'm making the music to drown out.
Oh, I thought you were
saying.
Doing Bane.
Oh, I thought it was a Bane impression.
No, that's not a Bane impression.
Sorry. No, like, Trip to Italy, which is also my top 10 list, has a great Bane impression in it.
And in Inception, he gave all of the like exposition to Ken Watanabe, who delivers it in this unintelligible accent.
True.
You know, it's like, but like back to Most Violent Year, it's like that. I mean, that film to me is imitation James Gray. It has qualities that I adore, but I feel like it's kind of not. It's not as he doesn't do as naturally what I think comes very this kind of classical, kind of patient. You know,
I'm not on the James Gray train.
Can we just talk about Most Violent Year for a second?
I think part of what's interesting
about it is it has a kind of classicism. A kind of very classical Hollywood cinema. Lumet is a perfect descriptor. But in terms of even how he's shooting, everything looks. Very classical.
Than
later Lumet, and yet what he's doing is that he's kind of wedding a certain look, but to a kind of a different kind of sensibility that is, to me, more kind of independent film, where he doesn't like to deliver a certain kind of ending. I mean, almost perverse. And I would say that All Is Lost, similarly, it doesn't have a certain kind of
payoff.
Hollywood payoff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He actually, if anything else, it's like he pulls, I don't think this metaphor is going to work, but I'm too tired and too hungover, pulls the rug under where he just says, I'm going to deny you this kind of ending. I'm going to do it this way.
He gives the movie a title that I think a lot of people are going to go to that movie and expect a certain kind of film when they don't get that.
It's like going to Drive.
They're not going to have the reaction. They're not going to push it.
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying I think it's interesting that that's, he's kind of wedding these two kind of traditions, a kind of classical Hollywood filmmaking
tradition
with independent film.
I think that tradition is actually HBO. I think that's where that comes out of, because you've got that kind of serialization and that kind of like anti-climax and the low-keyness, and you see it in Mad Men and you see it before in Sopranos, and it's like this kind of like...
But that's an art film tradition. They didn't invent it. That's really coming out of art cinema. I mean, we're talking about like the art film tradition where you're going to have...
The 400 Blows.
Elliptical, Antonioni. You know, you're going to have elliptical narratives. You're going to have like, what does it actually mean? What happened to her? She disappeared. we don't know at the end of it.
So like
that to me is an art film tradition.
I think it also has some big problems that are kind of spoiler related, including how they solve the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the. But
I'm not saying it fully works, but I just think that
it is a shame that movie here is kind of like not. I mean, it did get a first prize from, was it NBR, National Board of Review, or who?
I think so, and I think she's up for a Golden Globe.
So it's gotten some attention.
But the nature of the film is why it's getting the different kinds of reactions. I think.
I'm a big Shandor fan. I think he's three for three.
I didn't like Margin Call, but All Is Lost was great.
I love All Is Lost is probably still my favorite, but I think all three of them are really strong and. I think he's really interesting.
He's now officially someone you want to see what they do now.
Absolutely. Consensus has been issued.
Well, here's a foreign film I would have put in my top 10 that like I feel like didn't get the push that other foreign films have gotten is Violette.
Good movie.
When I finally saw it, I thought I was expecting something maybe so obtuse as to explain why it didn't get governed. No, I think this would
tell us about what that is.
It's basically the story of Violette Le Duc, yeah, who was a French writer in the 40s and 50s and was friends with
Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah. And Emmanuel Davis gives this incredible performance as this kind of like needy and talented and just, oh my gosh, she's just her. It's just
clingy and annoying,
a walking nerve for 2 hours. But you get to see her like fulfill her dream, and it's just beautiful.
Was there a documentary about Violette Le Duc?
I believe there has been.
To?
Yeah,
I remember at Outfest, I think we were looking at both of them, and we couldn't get either of them.
It does the thing that it's so hard to do, movies to do is actually tells the story of a writer writing.
Really, within a literary context.
Yes.
Like she's friends with Genet,
right.
She's kind of almost like not quite the female Genet, but there's a kind of he sees affinities, with himself, and that's really interesting.
I see this Oscar campaign season where it's all about these famous figures, Martin Luther King and Alan Turing, and like she should be in there.
That's a really difficult sell because she's a difficult woman, and difficult women are not very saleable, as we
know.
Well,
let's just
just admit
but it's
how
a French
hard
movie,
it is.
So you accept that.
It's okay, she's French.
It's right, exactly. How hard it is for any foreign film, though, to get traction in the States at all.
Right. It's awful. Like the, it's so awful.
I mean, Ida did. I mean,
I think the Ida phenomenon is really, like...
There's one. There's two words for the Ida phenomenon.
Tell me.
Laura Kim.
That joke is referring to the publicist behind the film. And
no, I will
the
say,
very great publicist.
I will,
who's kind of really,
I will say this. I think that for older Jewish audiences, they're like the last holdout of people who still take art film seriously.
You know, Ira Sachs told me as much. I mean, like, he thinks that his demographic for Love is Strange and just in, for films in general, not to mention his financiers, I think, you mm-hmm. know, he's basically able to be independent and to make films, you know, like he does, that because he's sort of amassed this kind of loyal, you know, patronage, basically, you know, the, but, and he basically pinned it down to that, you know, it's, and something like Ida, which for me looked phony when I saw it at Telluride, that movie took, you know, 6 months, I think, to kind of find a distributor, kind of like get any traction, start to come, and then it found its audience very organically, but like, it felt to me like the director, Pawlikowski, you know, sort of like trying to earn, this is probably a misreading on my part, maybe, but it, like, it just looked to me like he was, you know, doing that kind of movie for respect, you know, the way that Michael Keaton's character in Birdman is doing, you know, this play for respect. It's a very kind of natural thing when you've been kind of...
Well, like, the guy was, like the guy who made The Judge or the guy who made This Is Where I Leave You.
In other words, I don't know why Ida was in black and white and shot that way. Like, I still have yet to... I mean, that's what it feels like. It feels
Ida
a little
feels
superficial.
Like the kind of movie that, like, in a Woody Allen movie would be sort of like the joke of kind of like, you know, it would also be playing at the theater as the movie designed to win the...
At the Thalia. Yeah.
You have this great... You have a good story. You have a couple of really interesting characters. You have this one amazing performance, and you just don't need to, like... attach this kind of like,
but God love it for breaking through. I mean, that's the point. I mean, it's like for me, I was really hoping to find more French films to put on my top 10 list because that's been my focus for the last year, international and French cinema. And for me, the one that's exciting is television. It's a piece of television. This movie, Little Can-Can, which opens this month.
Oh right.
It's
on like Fandor or one of those sites, right?
It might be streaming as well. It's worth checking out. It's Bruno Dumont, who has always made these kind of like really kind of just grungy, kind of unbearably cynical portraits of humanity, including
is he the 29 Poems
guy? Yeah. And now he's come around to comedy, but in a very bleak... Have you seen it?
No, not yet.
In a very bleak, very cynical way. And it's a lot of... He's a director that I basically sworn off. I couldn't abide his films
me
any
too.
Longer. And so it took me a couple months after Cannes to catch up with that film. You know, it's like... And yet, like, it's so perverse, so funny. And it's kind of in that, you know, it's a murder mystery, but it's not really about solving it. I mean, it has ties to True Detective, these kind of things that we've been seeing. It's a four-hour... you know, done as multi-part thing for French television that has also been featured at Cannes. It's been featured at film festivals and it'll show in cinemas here. And to me, this is like just, and it's all...
No, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's terrific.
Were you guys fans of Force Majeure?
Yeah, I like it, you know. I mean, I don't think it's quite all that, but
The ending is a letdown, I thought.
You know, I think it has a really great, you know, it has a terrific bit of physical business, you know, and nothing quite, you know, I like it for a while. I just feel like it doesn't quite gather enough for me for the, you know, that's like the payoff is not quite enough for me.
I was with it and really liking where it was going and how dark it was getting and how it was just how uncomfortable.
It just gets a little glib for me.
But then there's that ending that's supposed to sort of wrap it up. And it's like, no.
Which, are you talking about the literal ending? Because there are almost several scenes that kind of resolve
the bus business at the end. That just,
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. I think what's interesting. Important to understand about that movie is that it's ultimately more intellectual. I mean, it's very cinematic in its own way, but like maybe not the last few scenes, but it's like, I mean, it's ultimately something that you're designed to digest and reflect on. And I don't know if the ending reads quite right in terms of the moment you're watching it, but I think what's important is like he's, after having kind of been emasculated and realized kind of, it's looking at gender roles and these kind of things, and at the end it's sort of, you know, they trust the woman's instinct in this potential catastrophe, and the movie leaves you with the question, rather than putting a bow on it, it leaves you with the question of, maybe that wasn't the right choice. Maybe they're all going to freeze to death in the cold at the end.
But it was just so neat. It was a little too neat for me. You know,
it was too parallel.
It was just too parallel.
I think even that intention, which I've tried to describe, I'm not sure if it even conveys directly. I mean, I had to sort of scratch and...
I don't know. I thought it was pretty transparent. Sorry.
We made it a point not to get into details, and I'll keep that this week. But my favorite ending of the year, no question, is 2 Days, One Night.
Oh, that was, I mean, that, yeah.
Like, that is how you end that story without pandering and without being Lars von Trier.
I mean, half of my brain is trying to think about it, and the other half is trying to be like, what is a better ending?
I completely forgot the ending.
So we'll talk off mic.
Okay.
They, just, they resolve it in the way that's just off-center, that's very...
I saw it in May, so...
You were talking earlier about, like, favorite scenes, and that movie has one of mine, which is earlier... I mean, it's like... I think it was Ebert who once said that, like, you know, thing, and I feel the same way, that things that sort of make him cry movie are not tragedy and whatever, but it's like when there's some outpouring of warmth or, like, compassion for someone else.
The laundromat?
And I'm thinking of the soccer field where she goes to...
Oh, I know.
I mean, basically the movie's about her going around asking everyone at her workplace where she's been laid off whether they'll sort of sacrifice, you know...
Their bonus so she can get a job
so that she can stay. Yeah. And, like, you know, this guy's reaction is just so... sincere and heartfelt. I mean, it's just you're
that wrecked. That and the laundromat both definitely got me. And thank you for reminding me about. Yeah, I did want to talk about just sort of favorite moments in movies that maybe otherwise didn't make our list.
My favorite ending, certainly one of my favorites, is Whiplash. I think Whiplash.
Oh God, yes.
I think Whiplash completely figures out. That's a movie that really could have gone in so many ways that you expect, and I think it ended. Just, I think it found the absolute perfect tone, and it stuck with the one thing that was actually in its favor was not. This not the revenge aspects, but the humor, the humor of the piece, the cruel humor was really served well.
That
was
more suspenseful than like any sort of superhero movie. I have to say,
as two-handers go, as a movie's about dueling wills.
It's not a perfect film, but that ending.
That movie's
great
with maybe the weakest climax of the year, with the sort of like business with the getting to the concert on time or whatever. But it has so much great, you know. It's and it sort of wraps
the
up
gambit.
So
the gambit at the end, though, is just so beautifully played. It was like an old school, like it felt like a screenplay you would have gotten in the 30s or 40s or something. You know?
Right, and unapologetically a B movie. You know, it's like
absolutely
thanks for that. Yeah.
It's been weird. That had like. I think at Sundance there were like three movies where it involved car crashes at climactic moments. Really. That was just a very strange.
There's a certain kind of shot that I know it's going to happen now. If you're in the passenger seat, showing the driver.
Exactly. With the cameras in a certain place, you know there's a car going to be
your friend. And when it doesn't happen, it's almost worse because you've like braced yourself. I think that started with Ronin. I was trying to think. But you're talking about the sort of like, you're looking perpendicular to the driver.
I think Sweet Dreams, I think, was the first one I remember.
Oh, I don't even know. What movie that is?
The biopic about Patsy Cline.
Oh, Patsy Cline
with Jessica Lange.
But special effects, visual effects, have made that shot more "quote unquote" realistic now in recent years. So you get a sense of
you
the
see
impact
the
of that.
Yeah.
I have three.
Go
three moments. Not counting the goat's buttholes in Monica Mata, which. Led, because I saw Monica Mata twice, and those were my two favorite film-going experiences of the year. The first time I saw it was in a screening room above the Lemley, and I shouted down a woman who would not stop talking.
Go back and listen to the episode. That's a heck of a story.
Uh-huh.
I took her to task in the middle of the film loudly. And repeatedly until she left.
Awesome.
Yeah. And then she complained about me to the people running the...
Awesome.
It was a rich experience. But the second time I saw it was I came home and I refused to tell Alonzo anything about the film. Because I knew that if I started explaining it, he'd be like, I don't have time for this. And so I drag him out to the movie. I drag him out to the music hall. And I watched the movie, but I was also watching him watch the movie. And so, like, about 20 minutes in, after the first two rides up the mountain, and it was silent, and he turned to me and he was like, like, is this the movie?
And, I believe I said, we're never getting out of this cable car, are we?
Yeah. But then the goats came on, and he starts convulsing of laughter. I was like, I win! Anyway, so besides the goat's buttholes in Monica Mata, I love the close-ups of the check writing in Abuse of Weakness, where she's writing him all those checks.
Uh-huh.
And every time she writes him a check, you're like, no, stop doing that! I love that. I loved the
No, I'm just, no, I just
while
blanked.
You're thinking, you know, I'm sorry, now should be a better partnership. Like Isabelle Huppert plus Catherine Breillat to me is like the ultimate kind of like power duo, and that was the movie we got, unfortunately. You know, it's yeah. Like, yeah, but
not I dug happy. The movie. I'm forgetting number three, but my other one is at the very end of We Are the Best. When they finish their show,
they're on the bus.
They're on the bus home. And they're like, "We are the best." And then the guys who were with them are like, "No, you are the worst." And they aren't even capable. These girls are not even capable of listening to that because they're like, "No, no, we are the best."
It's like a Beats headphones commercial. Listen to what you want to listen to, or whatever. Hear what you want to hear. It's like
I think all of the best scenes of the year have to come from Nymphomaniac.
I was going to say Uma Thurman.
Oh,
is
Uma Thurman.
That was one of my three.
One of the best scenes of the year.
The Uma Thurman moment. Yeah, I wish the whole movie had been her.
Any interaction between Scarlett Johansson and a guy she's trying to like pick up and kill?
Right. Oh yeah.
Don't get me started on that movie. I cannot stand it.
Oh, that was on my top five.
That was my top ten.
Please,
I love
please,
you, Manolo.
Please tell us more.
Yes. No, it's just nothing. It's like, I like looking at Scarlett Johansson naked, too. I need more in a movie. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, that's why
those
I like it.
Were like the,
I
those actually
boobies.
Were like the least.
I honestly, I don't think there's anything there. I just thought it was a big, you know, I can't say what I really thought because you'd have to bleep me out, but I just think it's a, I think
gonna,
it's a big fraud.
Anyway,
I don't know.
So.
I think it's terrible.
I don't know. That movie was to me like a portrayal of a certain kind of foreignness all the way through that I thought was just incredibly compelling.
For all the 2001 references
fake art movie.
That Interstellar was getting, I was like, no. This is the movie
well,
that's more like
was
that
original.
Of-
it is not my taste. I did not have any sort of interaction with it. You know, in terms of like what I hope for from a movie like that is that it at least let my mind go somewhere interesting. That if it's not feeding it to me, it, you know, it's like it'll kind of invite that. And I didn't have that.
No, my mind was out the door.
I love a movie that makes me work for it and gets me somewhere.
I don't
and
disagree,
I felt like I got that from
but it's certainly a film that I would sooner send people to go and experience than a lot of other than Interstellar. You know, it's like,
I guess in a way, my tolerance for fake art movies is that's like where I really get angry.
And Goodbye to Language. How can we like
oh,
have this?
But that's
in the
a
same
real. That's a real movie. That's
oh,
a
it's
real
Amateur
movie.
Hour from like someone who should be at the peak
no,
of his.
No, I think
like,
it's a
form.
Really great movie.
Goodbye to Language. The original title was. Does this bug you? Am I bugging you? Am I bugging you now? Does this bug you? I'm in 3D. Am I bugging you?
I finally caught up with that in Paris in a theater full
you
of people
wrong.
Who
so
like
wrong.
Are, you know are subscribed to sort of like you know this is a Godard movie and it sort of ended with people behind me getting up being like Godard like
have,
what do you expect?
Okay, we haven't talked about great documentaries of the year. My one that was in my top 10 was National Gallery, the Frederick Wise.
Oh, yeah. Dan's a big fan.
I love that movie.
Best
absolutely
movies I saw
wonderful.
Year, sure.
Me too. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand why. Okay, I'm sorry that I'm bringing the Oscars up again because we're kind of circling back to how
this
we started.
This is a discussion he and I have already had. So, keep
but
talking.
I'm really kind of very curious why Weissman has never been nominated.
Not even nominated.
When he is not just one of the best documentary filmmakers working today, he is one of the best filmmakers working today.
I don't get it. And there was
you know?
Point. There was a point a couple years ago. I mean, like you know, part of me like I feel like I know the answer to that question. No one wants to spend 3 hours and 4 hours in these situations. But when he made Boxing Gym, which was a
tight
cool,
90 minutes. I know.
And it was beautiful.
Crazy.
Okay.
Beautiful.
I have to be careful what I say here because there are NDAs involved. But 1 year I was non-disclosure agreements.
Okay, sorry.
But 1 year I was on a jury for something that involved documentaries.
A murder trial? Oh,
yeah.
No guessing. Some of us know the answer.
And there was a Weisman movie that year, and the other documentary filmmakers on that jury all were like, because they all don't like him. Like, they all had some personal beef with Weisman.
And that Oscar, you know,
and that Oscar
is chosen
by other documentary filmmakers.
It's sort of a boys club, you know.
So he's clearly pissed the wrong people off, and that's why, I think.
That clearly is probably the case.
Yeah. I want to circle back real quick. My other two favorite moments real quick were both kind of musical moments. One was the lip-syncing to Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now and the Skeleton Twins, which I know not everybody loved that movie, but it's a sublime moment, and
there
they do
great
the whole song.
Yeah.
My other one was in Space Station 76, which not a lot of people saw, but it's a gorgeous movie. And
I haven't even heard of it.
It was closing night at Outfest. It got a small theatrical release and pretty much went straight to streaming. It's Jack Plotnick's directorial debut, an actor that we know. And basically, the premise is it's sort of like the Ice Storm crossed with Space 1999. It's all done in a 70s sci-fi look, like what we thought the future would look like in 1977, but set against, you know, sort of people's
based
own
on a internal domestic production.
Drama. It was a stage show originally, yeah. Anyway, there's a scene where Matt Bomer's character has a young daughter, and they do a thing occasionally, you know, that they keep secret from the mother, where he'll turn off the gravity in the room, and the kid will float. And the kid floats, and they play Neil Sedaka's Laughter in the Rain.
Oh.
And I just, that was one of my favorite
Well, that reminds me, like, I mentioned Gloria, this movie, or this Chilean film earlier. That has a scene of the woman dancing... the woman who's the star of the movie, the main character, a middle-aged woman who's single, and she goes to these kind of like these clubs for people her age and for hookups and relationships, and occasionally she goes out dancing, and there's a scene of her just dancing to a disco song, and it's just one of the most glorious
Absolutely.
Things.
Yeah, it's a nice,
you
yeah.
can see it's an expression of pure happiness.
My favorite two music moments of the year are Mommy, when they sing Celine Dion in the kitchen, and it's just sort of like re-owning that song, and then is it out yet? Girlhood?
I hate that movie so much.
And I have to review that next week. And
I'm seeing it next week. I haven't seen it yet.
This is not a spoiler.
I talked to somebody who loved that movie, and then I know Richard Brody gave it 9 of his 10 slots on his 10 worst.
It is
list.
Really one of the worst movies I think I've seen in the last 10 years. And I don't agree with Mr. Brody that often.
And Girlhood has this great moment where they're singing Diamonds. You know, sort of like just kind of like as they're kind
I
of.
I haven't seen that. That's
okay.
opening.
Yeah.
Soon.
It's premiering at Sundance, and then it's going to open here.
This is the problem with living on
Europe time. You know? I know one of Dave's favorite musical moments is
Boogie
year.
Woogie Rock and Roll
in The Identical.
Of The Identical.
Which was in a year full of terrible faith-based movies, this was the one that I told everybody they had to see.
Yeah, because there were more than 9, but I saw 9 Christian films this past year. And
dear Lord.
And
I saw 2.
Three of them were inoffensive and harmless. The
football one?
Or
there were 2 football ones.
The Heaven thing.
Year.
Heaven is for Real is sort of like innocuous.
And you were kind of a Mom's
Exodus.
Night Out.
And Mom's
Noah.
Not Mom's
we're
Night
not
Out.
Counting those.
I don't count
Mom's
Exodus
Night Out.
Because they don't come from that place. They don't come from those like little pockets of
evangelical kind
folks,
of.
Evangelical production companies.
Go on.
But The Identical is insane. And not insane, like God's Not Dead is insane, but toxic and horrible and cruel and should be seen because it damns its own creators. But The Identical is insane in that delirious, like, where did this come from?
Well, like,
kind of way where you like, there's that element, the thing I always say, there's that element of mystery, like, who made this?
Like
and
that Warren
why?
Christmas from a couple years ago?
Yeah, Last Ounce of Courage.
Last
This is almost more getting into like, I called it Oogie Loves for Adults.
It's
wacky. I mean, it's just, you just look at it, you're thinking, who? What? Why?
My favorite, or my obsession right now, is related to an older, you know, movie that falls in. It's The Room, of course, you know, the Tommy Wiseau movie that plays Midnight. But, you know, I caught up with The Book on Tape, which is read by Greg Sestero.
Oh, the Disaster Artist.
Yeah, The Disaster Artist.
I need to read that.
It's the same book that, you know, has been optioned by Seth Rogen's company. James Franco will pay Tommy Wiseau. This book, you know, sort of autobiographical by longtime Tommy Wiseau friend and co-star
of the film,
Greg Sestero, who reads it. And who does, anytime he's quoting Tommy, he does this amazing impression, which I can't replicate. But it's, I mean, like, it's just this, it's side, so read the book as an audiobook. I mean, have it read to you, because it's like, it's just amazing.
Excellent.
I stand in line with Tommy Wiseau at the post office at least once every 10 days.
I hear he's got some sitcom he's shopping right now.
Oh, yeah, The Neighbors.
He plays
but
a
he
crazy
lives,
landlord.
He, lives in
he plays 2 characters, apparently.
He lives in this neighborhood. He and I are post office buddies.
That's nice. No, I did a story way back when where I met with him and sat down at Jerry's Deli, and we had a long, you know, 90-minute conversation that was surreal, where he wouldn't answer any of the questions, you know. But, like, the answers to all of my questions are held in that book, you know.
Nice.
Yeah, the best bad movies are the ones you just don't know where they came from, like, you know, after last season, and Miami Connection was on TCM last night, which is made by this, like, Asian motivational speaker, and it's all about, like, cocaine and ninjas.
That's the film that the Cine family's obsessed with, and it rolls out all the time, yeah.
Even our discussions of good movies wind up in this territory.
So my favorite scene of the year comes from How to Train Your Dragon. It's
The fireplace scene?
Oh, I'm thinking the reunion between sort of the Cate Blanchett character, whose backstory we haven't realized.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And sort of what's the chief's name? You know?
Oh, right, right.
Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler.
Right, exactly.
Whatever his name is.
Humongous or something.
Yeah.
I came to appreciate gunshots to the head more this year from the movie John Wick. With
thank you for bringing that movie
that
up.
That is such
a
good movie. I'm so surprised that it didn't take off better.
I know.
Because it's
so
good.
That was
I thought it did.
I think it's done like... I'll look it up.
40 mil?
It had a weak opening, and I was really sad because...
I
no, it's, it delivers
so
much.
No,
it's a peerless shot, actually.
I will see it, but you have to see The Raid, too.
Here, I'm going to look it up because as a Variety employee, I shouldn't just be spouting wrong box office.
Did it do Boffo Biz?
No, I think it's done like 40...
It did have a... It had a huge opening. It had great reviews.
I didn't think it had
a
huge opening.
I think it's done like 40 mil.
No, for what it was number one its weekend. I mean, it's like the... It's sort of like... It came out of nowhere because, like, I remember that one actually opened in Paris before it opened.
Okay.
Every once in a while, this happens where it lands in my lap over there.
No, it was so a deeply enjoyable movie. I mean, really.
And by the way, made in a way that is fallen away for action movies, where it's like you can follow the
action.
That's one of the reasons I think it's so great. Is
made by these two stunt guys.
It's a movie actually directed.
Yep,
it's an action movie that's together.
We'll be talking about Taken 3 later, but let me tell you, you have never seen... These are like the goodbye to language action scenes, practically. It's these discrete moments of things happening chopped together.
That's interesting, because, I mean, not the other... Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
The first one is effective, the second one is dopey, and this one is
the second was not good.
Yeah, the second one's terrible. This one's, like, flat out incompetent.
I'm so interested in the older male movie star doing the kind of late John Wayne Avenger thing. You know, it's just so interesting thinking about, because I had just watched The Equalizer.
Right.
Yes. A truly terrible movie, but
I just
watched it.
Too,
although, actually, one of my favorite moments, I'd say, is the whole Home Alone sequence at the end where we booby trapped the entire hardware store.
Shot.
Right.
So I couldn't see it. I couldn't see what was going on. I mean, it was like, you wanted to enjoy that more.
But did you watch it at home?
I watched it at home.
Because on the big screen, I didn't have that problem.
Yeah. No, I watched it at home, but I was very interested, because it really is these kind of late John Wayne kind of like, you know, going to walk in and like take care of everything. But, you know, these men in their 60s playing these kind of kick-ass.
Kevin Costner's tried to do it this past year.
Yep.
Liam Neeson sort of burst the door open.
Exactly.
Because Taken, apparently, he said he thought it was going to go straight to DVD.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly became this phenomenon.
No, The Equalizer was just,
that
I was just saying, it was
But Denzel's been doing it
through my
head. Denzel's doing it with before.
I'm back in touch with everybody.
He was, but it's just like, you know, he's playing a much, he has a kind of physical solidity, you know, that you feel his age, cause he's, and it's just, you know, he's not kind of trying to look younger, and you're just aware of, like, he looks like, you know, he's working in a kind of Home Depot-like store, and you kind of buy that.
And he never takes his shirt off. There's no sense that he wanted to work out for the movie.
No.
The key difference is he's not an action star, so it makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
It makes it the Harrison Ford thing, where an ordinary guy is kind of being roped into this, whereas, like, all these other guys, because Hollywood has not given us a new generation of action star...
Expendables.
I love that Chris Pine has arrived this year. You know, not Chris. Sorry, what's his name? The star of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Chris Pratt.
I mean, like, I love what he represents as kind of a potential new kind of, like a kind of wink. You know, wink, wink.
I think Paul Rudd and Ant-Man is probably going to be along those lines.
Right,
as well.
That could be too. But otherwise, I mean, like, we just haven't gotten those guys. And so what we have is this kind of aging, you know, kind of the Bruce Willis's and Stallone still coming up.
If Keanu Reeves can give me what he gave me in John Wick,
absolutely.
I'll be happy with him doing these
things
for a while.
Agreed.
And the underrated Man of Tai Chi, which
he
directed.
What I don't think he really did was the whole kind of like that idea that he'd really sort of given up that lifestyle and come back to it. I mean, that's part of that story. And I mean, I like so much about that. I don't know why I'm like quibbling. By the way,
the dog was very nice in that movie.
By the way, the answer to the numbers was it opened number two after Ouija that weekend.
Yeah, that's what
it opened to 14 million and it made 42. So it could have done better than that. And yet, I think it outperformed anything they expected. So it's somewhere in between.
No, but it's like when Taken makes 100 and something mil and then John Wick only makes 40, it's like, what does that mean?
I think that there are certain stars that rub people the wrong way. I think part of the reason that Live, Die, Repeat wasn't a bigger deal was because a lot of people actively don't like Tom Cruise Or they feel like that Tom Cruise just made that movie because the way they marketed it made it look a lot like Oblivion.
And Liam Neeson in the Taken movies, there is like an emotional component to the whole mother daughter thing that probably appeals to a certain conservative mindset that there's a guy out there, you know.
Oh yeah, well that movie is so jingoistic. It's like so many like these lecherous brown men trying to get their hands on this white virgin.
Right.
The Tombstones. That was another one. I was trying to remember the other Liam Neeson.
I didn't see that one.
Oh, Walk Among the Tombstones.
Walk
Among
the Tombstones, which had a kind of interesting kind of pulp B,
which also didn't do that hot.
No, it didn't do very well at all.
But that's also based on really, you know, effective novels.
Yeah, but very harsh. Really harsh.
The movie whose success I couldn't sort of get this year was Lucy, which just like it was kind of hilarious.
Lucy,
and it's like Lucy.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's a good movie, though. I'm not saying it. The reader got really mad because I called Luc Besson a hack. And I'm like, you know. But, you know, I think it's good for what it is.
It wasn't not fun.
It was fun.
It was just dopey.
I just thought it had one of my least favorite scenes. There's a scene of her coming out and she asks if someone speaks English and he says no and she shoots him. Which is, you know, kind of a repeat of the old Raiders of the Lost Ark,
right.
Pull out a gun, you know, somebody has a bullwhip and you just shoot them, you know, because there's something very unpleasant about that. And then when you think about the politics of them, the representational politics of Lucy, hordes of men of color chasing down this white lady.
Well, I mean, in general, strange. That's where that movie, I mean, it's fun, it's a ride, it's like, it's got a lot of energy to it. I mean, it has a lot of kind of what I liked about that movie, Mr. Nobody, where it's just like experimenting with things, you know, but it's like it's a movie about using 100% of your brain it demands that you turn your own off when you walk through the door. And I just, like, I couldn't deal with that. You know, it's like, it was such a...
And if you use 100% brain, you will eventually just become a zip drive or whatever.
A flash
drive.
My favorite scene of the year is a spoiler. So, again, and it's for Maleficent.
That's on DVD.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And it really is the thing that made that movie really work. And I'll say I burst into tears when it happened. Is that it's the kiss of Maleficent that wakes up Sleeping Beauty, and that changes a narrative paradigm that has been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah. By the way, a narrative paradigm that's like been getting like stomped on in really interesting ways with,
interesting, isn't it?
I mean Frozen. I mean, I think the idea that Frozen. The men are so ancillary in that.
But I mean,
and
I would
Duet and Frozen Into the Woods.
But this Maleficent even pushes that even further than Frozen does.
I mean, it banishes the men.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, oh yeah, there's that prince guy over there, you know, but meanwhile, this is all about these Maleficent, you know, and this girl.
And in a strange way, Babadook, I think, is a paradigm shift too, because it's about acknowledging emotions that mothers have that, you know, is not considered very,
It's
a waterfall about the often, you know, the mother's desire to, like...
Difficult maternal issues.
Difficult maternal things.
And Handel, I think, I don't know what you guys thought about this movie, I much more bought it out of the Babadook than I did out of We Need to Talk About Kevin. Which to me just was so drowning in style that I never bought it for a second. Yeah. And this felt so genuine and gritty.
How could you buy that movie? From the get-go, she's announcing her themes with every single shot. I mean, she's a beautiful shooter, you know. Mm. Lynn Ramsey is really, you know, her movies look very beautiful. I don't think that they actually have the payoff of the beautiful shooting. But in this case, you know, from the very beginning when you see Tilda Swinton in a sea of red, you're just like, here comes the theme of the movie. Oh, it's in big letters.
The fact you had to start looking for the red thing in every scene, became the Where's Waldo, that movie.
Yeah, right. It was like, because it's basically, to me, it's basically saying we're not smart enough, you know, and so that has to be announced again and again and again, you know. Did you get the point yet?
It's like going to hear Peter and the Wolf with a narrator, you know, like letting you know, like, the oboe represents the cat. I'm going to throw out one last question. I will let you guys get on with your lives. Do we think that everything that went down with the interview is going to do for VOD what Serial did for podcasts in terms of people who maybe didn't know what it was before, didn't want to do it, suddenly
started noticing. When people call it a game changer, I'm like, no, because the interview was basically giving everybody a chance to see a major, 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 you know, Hollywood studio motion picture at home. Right away. I mean, that's not going to be the case with every single VOD movie that comes out.
Right, but my question, though, is do we think the people who never grasped what the notion of VOD was and never did. Like in the
like
way
now that they know
like,
how to get
when Serial became a big deal, like the New York Times or the New Yorker or somebody actually had a sidebar explaining, here's what a podcast is, here's how you listen to a podcast. Da, da, da. And I think do we think that the interview did the same thing for VOD in terms of
who doesn't know VOD? Really? I think my mom does, honestly.
But the generation that everyone cares about in Hollywood. Yeah, they all know what
well, obviously, yes.
Yeah. I don't think it's a game changer, and I think it's kind of, I would be very surprised if Sony thought it was, certainly.
I think this is fair. More people, like, that was probably the first film I had VOD'd in 5 years, you know, through this whole kind of rise of the VOD. It's just like, you know,
really?
You and I have the opportunity to get access to movies without using VOD, just mm-hmm. by, you know, asking, I mean, I'm skipping over the kind of like, send me a Vimeo link of that film and I'll watch it, but like paying, you know, mm-hmm. through whatever outlet, and I don't even know how to do it through my
cable
box.
Well, we VOD stuff a lot of times if it's available on demand before it opens theatrically and our review has to match the theatrical date, it's easier to spend the $10 and watch it at home than it is to like,
and for research,
but it's easier still for you or me to email the publicist and say, you know, send me that movie. You know, it's like for me, that really was kind of like the first time I had just gone through that process, certainly the first time on YouTube, where I'd never paid YouTube for, you know, something. And it's like, that may be the game change thing of it. It just was like a cherry moment, you know.
But I would say that, because I rented it through YouTube as well, I found the interface really terrible, at least how it was set up at home.
And the ultimate quality of it.
I was running back and forth to my office to look things up. And I'm not a technological moron. I'm just not. And it was just, the interface was so terrible. So I think that there is a level that it has to be very easy, and it's not. I mean, video on demand is, generally speaking, do you want to rent it, yes or no? It wasn't the case with this because you had to have a code and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was just kind of really irritating.
Well, I don't even remember that part of the process. Yeah. I just remember the checkout being weird. But
it was actually a pain in the
ass. Now Amazon has their version of Apple TV that you literally just plug into the side of your set. So, you know, I mean,
but
that might be
the thing is, like, I don't know if this is what's behind your question, but it's the question about, you know, does that mean the end of theatrical or pushing it?
No.
Okay,
I just meant in terms of people who maybe were vaguely aware of VOD, but never felt like
they maybe. Who knows? I mean, there's no way to really quantify that.
Sure.
But when you heard the word game changer being used, I think it was this notion that maybe like Tom Cruise is not going to make a movie and release it on VOD first or whatever, and that's not going to happen.
That's absurd. What companies want is they want to have as many different ways to have us pay as possible.
Right,
and theatrical is the first time you pay.
Exactly.
And then you're going to pay later on in different kinds of windows, you know, you're not going to get rid of one of your most lucrative, you know, opportunities to squeeze the consumer.
Seth Rogen's next movie is not going to be for VOD.
You're going to squeeze them first theatrically, then you're going to have VOD, and then you're going to have Netflix, and you just have all these different ways to pay.
But, you know, Adam Sandler, who I would very happily go through life without ever seeing any more of his movies, is making 3 films for Netflix. I mean, there is...
And I may be canceling my subscription.
Just to not be in the same shopping forum.
Even though Netflix is how I saw Violette, this movie that I just...
Exactly.
I
no, no.
Now,
so. If he goes on...
That's where I watch TV.
If he has a star... If he has like a little guest starring role on Orange is the New Black, then I'll definitely be watching. But not until then.
If he gets shivved, especially.
I think as critics, we sort of like... We sort of anticipate like that the next Adam Sandler movie is going to be awful or whatever. And like
it is.
But they are not all awful. I mean, there are Punch Drunk Loves and things like that. I didn't see the
Punch Drunk Love doesn't count.
That's a singularity there.
That and Funny People are like in its own other little...
But I mean, I felt like this year actually brought surprises for me. I mean,
well, here's what bugs me about... Sorry, just real quick. What bugs me about... not only did I like Funny People, but the fact that in Funny People he makes fun of the kind of movies that he's been making up until then.
True,
and then he keeps making them! It's like you already acknowledge that you know this is an awful thing
you're
and
gonna
you're still
make people,
doing it.
Right. You know, buy your vomit and laugh about it. That's what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, if Michael Keaton goes back to making
exactly
Batman movies,
right,
you lose.
Right.
You know?
Bingo.
But, yeah. But, yeah,
perfect
exactly.
Example. Anyway, sorry, what you were saying?
No, I was just thinking, like, I had a self-conscious moment this year, you know, reviewing Force Majeure, which is a movie that I kind of raised my hand because my least favorite movie I've ever seen at Cannes was his last film. Ruben Östlund made a film called Play, and it's like...
I don't like that movie either.
I mean, it's just like, it sort of represented everything about the kind of movies that Cannes encourages that I don't like, this kind of distance, the lack of, you know, kind of filmmaking in them. And the... And so I kind of was like, well, you know, I'm going to punish that movie, you know, in
we're not going to do that.
No, what I mean, not I don't mean that I had prejudged or done whatever.
Just like the
thing.
Critic in Birdman, which is so realistic.
No. That was a theme this year. There were a lot of movies about
I should
about
be very clear that, I mean, rather what I mean is that, like, you know, I knew that that was a style that I didn't like, and I was like, you know, if
you
I
brought Steak
again,
Sauce into the theater with you.
Right, I mean, yeah. It's that, and it's like, and what I loved is that movie, like, had basically taken that thing that had really rubbed me wrong prior, and it had evolved it, and had used it in a different way, and,
yep.
it, and it's one
yep.
of my favorite movies, and it's like, and the moral of this is, you know, just sort of realizing that there's nothing that I could want more than to be surprised by someone
oh, yeah.
who's, you know, sort of like chronically
Well, Busted Clock is always is right twice a day.
Exactly.
No, you're right. There is nothing more pleasurable than going into something like The Three Stooges, you know, thinking it's going to be the worst thing ever, and then just like
enjoying it,
completely
yes.
enchanted
yeah.
by it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, even say Grand Budapest Hotel, I'd sort of gotten to a point, or Bruno Dumont, it's like I'd gotten to a point with these filmmakers where I felt like I'd figured them out. They weren't going to surprise me. There wasn't going to be something that, and
yeah.
their latest film.
I felt like Wes Anderson came out the other side of something in these last couple of movies.
Right,
Get On Up, you know, I hated The Help with a passion.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, oh brother, this is going to be like this sort of, you know, by the numbers biopic. And even the first couple of minutes of that movie where he's backstage talking to himself, you're thinking, oh, it's going to be one of these. And then it's not. And they start jumping around, and it's like, and Chadwick Boseman's performance is so great. That was my biggest surprise this year. That I thought I was totally going to hate, and then really kind of
I think it's incumbent on us always to walk in. I mean, you know, I've liked Ron Howard movies.
Yeah.
Rush.
Oh, Rush.
Thank
he
you.
Made
yes.
his best movie just last year.
Yeah.
I know. So, you know, miracles happen, man.
No. So, yeah, It's impossible not to walk in with the baggage that an artist has created.
Right.
But it's also, if we keep ourselves open to surprise, that's our job. And that's
well, and
the
I think
exciting
you're
part.
In a much better position with critics or with me as a moviegoer, if my expectations are low, 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 then if they're kind of like built up and it's the film I most want to see this year, you know, it's like the...
I
think the other thing is then we don't want to, like, have these expectations about great filmmakers and expect them always to, like, have this level, or they've reached this masterpiece level and just expect them to keep delivering masterpieces when maybe actually they're going to make different kinds of movies.
Right.
And then
yeah.
maybe they're pushing themselves in one way. And so it's not going to be like, you know, and I feel like the filmmakers get punished because we expect something from mm-hmm. them. Oh, you made a masterpiece, deliver it again. You know
and
what I mean?
Yeah,
like
France, you know, than it does here in the States. It's just a tendency of kind of, you know, tourism and looking at like a body of work and
The idea that Almodovar can't make I'm So Excited after making The Skin I Live In, it's like, I think after The Skin I Live In, he deserves to make
Well,
a,
he
could,
he's
you know,
he's basically allowed to make anything he wants.
Absolutely,
and I think
yeah.
what that's the problem, you know. I mean, it's like people being angry that, you know, Radiohead made suddenly different kinds of music. It's
right.
like, you can't do that. Let the filmmaker go in different places, and you need to go with that filmmaker. You know, in those kind of
when Hitchcock made Psycho, he was coming off of
absolutely
really slick and glossy movies, and people were like, "What the hell?"
He was inspired by TV.
Yep, absolutely.
That's what Psycho was inspired by television.
I think we're going to leave it there.
All
right. This has been an awesome discussion. Thank you guys for being here. We're gonna come back in a second to talk about Taken 3. But Robert Abley, Manolo Dargis, Peter DeBruge, where can people find you online, real quick? Robert, you're R-A-A-B-L-E at Twitter, R-A-A-B-E-L-E. Manola, you're completely invisible on social media, right?
Oh, yeah, no.
NYTimes.com.
Yeah, that's a little website we have.
And Peter, you're...
I'm Ask DeBruge. I don't tweet nearly enough anymore, but you can find me at Variety.com.
Okay, cool.
And my reviews appear in the LA Times.
At LA Times, right. And you guys all have a Rotten Tomatoes page, so, you know. Anyway.
With a picture from when I was 12, I believe.
Thank you for joining us today. And,
thank you, it's fun.
I hope 2015 gives us more and better movies.
Yay!
Okay, we're back. Dave and I are just going to talk about this week's
finally I get
one
a chance
big
to
release.
Talk.
No one's stopping you. You clam up when there's guests in the room.
No, I intentionally climb up when there's guests because I want them to have. I mean, they came to our house.
Mm-hmm.
They're here for a reason, and that's the talk. And the audience who listens to this show, they hear me every week jawing on and on and on and on. So especially if we have three folks,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, I do my best to, like, not talk over.
No, you're a mic hog.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Can I help it if I'm so fascinating and have so many important things to share with the world?
I'm going to get back to you with my answer about that.
So Taken 3.
It sucks. Goodbye. End of podcast.
Oh, man. Look, the first one has a lot wrong with it, but it's sure fun, you know, and
the first one is weird and like gross and racist and xenophobic and paternalistic and borderline incesty and weird and exciting. And there's so much killing.
Yes.
So much hilarious fun killing going on in the first Tooken. But then Tooken 2 is dumb.
Step down.
Dumb. Big step just down. Dumb. And then this one is sad. This one doesn't have anything happening. Everyone looks bored. No one seems to be having a good time. Liam Neeson, my favorite. Here, the best things about this movie are Liam Neeson running, and they tight close up on him so much that you can't really see the way his body moves when he runs.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I didn't really notice
he runs weird because he's a super tall guy and now he's a super tall old guy and he runs like if you see an old guy out jogging in the morning and he's sort of like red buttons on the deck of the Poseidon, you know, that's the way Liam Neeson runs in this movie. And he doesn't even go very fast. So these other people are chasing him and I'm like, y'all could totally catch him.
You know, the crazy thing about this these movies, like in the first one, it's sort of a gradual reveal that he is the baddest of all badasses, you know, and that you do not mess with Liam Neeson, you do not Tooken his daughter or else, you know, you will get it in the face.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, it's sort of like more of the same, but then they try and mix it up by having like the daughter do some of the rescuing, that he's coaching her on the phone, but even that doesn't make sense half the time. And then this one, it's like they don't even...
Daughter of Tooken.
Yeah, they don't even try to give him a worthy adversary. Like, the LAPD is after him, but...
They're like the Keystone Cops.
Except for Forrest Whitaker, who is sort of in his own movie,
Bagel-sniffing Forrest Whitaker.
You know, they don't even try to give him a credible force. If you go back to the trailer, it's like, the FBI, the CIA. No, there is no FBI or CIA in this movie. It's just the LAPD.
It's just the LAPD. And they're not even... They're bumbling.
Super bumbling. Or you've got these Russian gangsters who are basically the opulence, I has it guy from those DirecTV commercials that are just, you know, they're all just decked out in Versace and they're goofuses, you know. So, of course, Liam Neeson can mop up these guys because they're all jokes, you know.
I've been going back and forth between thinking, is this a good bad or a bad bad? And... It's a good bad. I think it'll be a good bad on video, streaming, DVD, whatever, Blu-ray, if you've got some friends over.
Sure.
Then it will be a good bad. But if you're in a theater on opening weekend watching this movie, it's just a bad bad.
And the action sequences, which is the whole point of this movie's existence, are so... I've never seen that more weirdly edited, just like...
Well, it's PG-13 editing. It's just the suggestion of everything.
But that's one thing we're talking about, like blood and guts. But I mean, even the car chases or the fist fights,
I know.
It's these sort of discrete ETE images kind of locked together, no flow, no geographical sense of thing going into thing. I was reminded of Goodbye in a Language. It was so bizarrely put together. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I've seen bad action editing before, but this is a whole new level of what are you even thinking, Monsieur Megaton?
I'm a big fan of getting Los Angeles wrong.
Yes.
In film, it makes me laugh every single time. And if you don't live in Los Angeles,
you don't know.
You don't know. But if you do, it's like this extra added bonus thrill of seeing how completely dumb the geography
you're
is.
You're going to get from downtown to Santa Monica in 15 minutes.
Seriously, in 1 second, they're on the 110. They're getting on the 110. And then the next second, they're at the Santa Monica airport.
I don't think you could get from downtown to the Santa Monica airport like in I Am Legend. Like if there was nobody on the freeway and you had, you could go 120 the whole way. I still think you couldn't do it.
It calls to mind my favorite old ABC Family television show, S Club 7 in Hollywood, in which our heroes, the singing group S Club 7, lived in the hills, but were at the beach every day. And then at the end of each episode would be dancing on the roof of a skyscraper downtown.
Right.
And I kept expecting X Club 7 to show up and dance on the roof of a skyscraper. And this would be like, oh, now we're at the Santa Monica Airport. Now we're at the Santa Monica Airport. Ladies and gentlemen, S Club 7. Here they are. Like, that's...
It couldn't have hurt.
Yeah. And so this is... it's. Don't see it.
No.
Wait. Enjoy the pleasures of Tooken 3 with your friends while you're drunk sometime.
And don't drive.
And don't drive anywhere near this movie. Wait for it to come to you.
Yes.
And then... order some wings and have friends over to watch it. If you're going to waste your time, it was 100 minutes. If you're going to waste 100 minutes of your life, do so high with folks and food.
And this was the big hot opening of the weekend, yeah. So Taken 4 is not to be assumed.
There's not going to be a 4. If there is, it'll be straight to home, blah, blah, whatever.
To Forkin, you know, it'll be the A will be a thing. Yeah. So speaking of DVD, do you have a DVD pick for this week?
No, I got nothing.
Oh, come on. Just pull something out of your hat.
I cannot
let it go unnoted that The Identical...
Oh yeah, there's
comes out on Blu-ray this week.
We, then you and I agree.
It's our joint one, yeah.
You and I agree. The Identical comes out this week. I didn't realize it was The Identical.
If you did not take our word for it and go see
this
thing,
when is Safe? When you got? I saw the Criterion.
Safe is out. It's already out.
The Criterion Safe came. Yeah. Did we already talk about that?
We have. No.
Well, Safe then.
Great.
Also,
okay, good.
But watch a double feature.
Yes, the sublime to the ridiculous.
And Safe. Safe, the greatest American film of the 1990s, and then The Identical, which was the greatest mystery film of the
2014.
Of 2014. Yeah. Of 19, 2014.
Perfect. you know what? This is a long show. I'm not going to do my usual list of stuff to listen to.
Good.
You know what they are. I do want to give a shout out to a podcast that I started listening to this week that I'm finding super compelling. It's called The Worst Idea of All Time, in which two New Zealand comedians watch Grown Ups 2 over and over again once a week for... excuse me. For 52 weeks.
Yeah.
I've gotten up to about week 12. The show is somewhere in the 40s, so these guys are near the end of their mission.
Yeah.
I
listened to it once this week with you in the car.
It's hilarious.
It's hard to understand these guys.
Well, after a couple episodes, you get attuned to their Kiwi accents. Because
I'll tell you, Australia is one thing, but New Zealand is a whole other thing.
the
are you all right? You're going to die?
I'm fine. The accents are thick, but it's a fun, fun show. And whether or not... It's funny, because at the end, they end every episode with, don't see the movie. Which is absolutely true. Don't see Grown Ups 2. And you don't have to have seen Grown Ups 2 to enjoy
the podcast, but if you do,
you'll enjoy it more.
Which one has the ice cream machine diarrhea?
That's Grown Ups 2.
Okay, well, that's really a great moment. In Grown Ups 2.
I'm still... They've mentioned it a couple times. They have not really mentioned the one thing in Grown Ups 2 that made me laugh. The scene-stealing cast member, which is the inflatable raft.
Yeah.
The inflatable raft out-acts everybody in Grown Ups 2, and it provides only laughs.
I'm just gonna cast a solid vote for the ice cream machine diarrhea moment.
All right. Well, yeah.
Because that's...
Part of the podcast, they do the Shining moment, where the one thing in the movie that week that they thought was the best
thing. That is the Shining. I think that is the Shining, the shiniest Shining moment of Grown Ups 2, is the diarrhea ice cream machine.
So yeah, so check out The Worst Idea of All Time. It's a fun show. We, as always, thank Blue for our wonderful theme music, and you can find more about him and his work at Bluetopia.com. Bluetopia. Subscribe to this show for free at iTunes and leave us a nice review. Several of you have, and we appreciate it. And the more good reviews we get, the better placement we get on their sort of main pages, and that always helps us find listeners. And really what helps us find listeners is you guys talking about the show and posting links to the show. And so all of you who do that on Twitter and on Facebook or wherever else,
force your friends.
We really appreciate it and keep up the good work.
Explain podcasts to your friends.
Exactly. You can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com or on a handy little app on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. And while you're on Facebook, you can also join the Linoleum Knife group page where our listeners get together to talk about movies. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast and drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with any questions, queries, whatnot. And we are still a little behind on getting the new episode, our special episode out for Poseidon Adventure.
You know, we're very busy men, and you'll get what you get when you get it.
We're working like that.
Yeah.
And we didn't have an actual ad this week for The Real Truth, Everything You Didn't Know You Need to Know About Making an Independent Film by Reed Martin.
But you should still buy
it. As always, we recommend that book, and we'll be back with more ads on that next week, I hope. And until then, hope you enjoyed this long episode with guests, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.